Welcome to the Poetic Justice Dialogue Series. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my guest, Sarah Kenzior. So Sarah is independent writer for Al Jazeera English. She covers politics, the economy, and media. She's best known for her articles on what she calls the prestige economy, as well as the crisis of higher education and the exploitation of unpaid labor. Sarah has a PhD in cultural anthropology, and her academic research focuses on digital media and politics in former Soviet authoritarian states, and she's been published widely in journals and online magazines. And I personally came across Sarah's work a few months ago at a time when I was myself considering whether to go back to school to pursue graduate work, and I was fighting with a lot of questions about debt and still working off my undergrad debt from my arts degree, and was trying to weigh the costs and benefits of doing a master's in today's economy. And I also having lots of friends and young people in my life wrestling with similar questions and career choices. So in the midst of all that, I found Sarah's writing and her honest insights and knowledge into these issues really powerful and informative, if not difficult to hear at times also, but really offering something valuable and insightful for my generation to think about. So it's a real pleasure to have you here, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk specifically about higher education, but before we get more specific into that, I'd love to just have you briefly talk about what you call the prestige economy. And this is a term you've become well known for writing about. So what is the prestige economy? When did it arise? And what do you see as its main impacts today?
Well, the prestige economy is the trade-off of a paid salary for things like attention or exposure or promise of opportunities of employment that usually never come. It's a way to convince people to work unpaid. The etymology of the word prestige is illusion, and that's basically what it is. It's branding institutions who trade on their reputation, usually formed in the old economy, to lure people to work in for free in the new economy. I started writing about this, you know, in part out of my work on academia, you know, which is a key example of how this works. You know, most work in academia revolves around prestige and is unpaid, but I found it translated more broadly into things like unpaid internships and unpaid work in industries ranging from arts and entertainment to policy and law. It's really something that, especially since 2008, has kind of buffered the American economy. You know, people are given this mantra, wait it out, things will get better. This is a temporary stopgap in employment patterns. Eventually, you're going to find a job. And then what they find is usually more unpaid labor.
Right. And so this is affecting our generation more than any generation before, basically.
Yeah. I mean, this generation has the worst employment opportunities of any generation since the Great Depression. And, you know, a lot of times I get emails from people saying, like, I want to begin my life. I'm waiting for things to change so that my life can start. And, you know, all I can really say to them is, your life is now. You know, this isn't a temporary change. Right. This is a structural change, a structural shift that's sort of been justified by the fact that we had an economic collapse. I think that corporations and institutions have found a way to capitalize on this situation by basically not paying people, because they've realized that people will work for free. People are that desperate, you know, the labor situation is that dire that they can have this happen indefinitely.
Right. Okay, well, let's jump into higher education. We'll come back into all these topics. They'll tie in together. Just to highlight, I wanted to start with a few statistics just to give people a sense of what's happening. So in 2011, American national student loan debt officially surpassed $1 trillion. Recently, the New York Fed reported that during just the third quarter of 2012, non-real estate household debt rose $62 billion nationally, and $42 billion of that was student loan debt. Adjusted for inflation, students are borrowing twice the amount of money for school that they did merely a decade ago. Tuition from 1979 to 2010 increased 175% in private colleges and 220% in public universities. At the same time, 53% of recent college graduates are jobless or unemployed in the States. Ron Brownstein, editorial director of the National Journal, said recently in an interview that in regards to millennials, we are seeing the potential of an economically lost generation. So, Sarah, I wanted to ask you, you know, can you explain to us how we got in this situation? How has student loan debt gotten so high and is increasing at such an unprecedented pace? And where is all the money going if it's not going to lowering tuition rates for future students?
Those are great questions. Well, one thing that's changed significantly in the last 25 years is that a college BA became a requirement for entry into a lot of white collar professions. And so it used to be possible that you could, you know, have a high school diploma and get a job and feed your family on that job without having to do this. And so what we have now, you know, is a credential that's de facto required. And because of that, you can ramp up the cost of that credential and people will be willing to pay it because they know that the consequence of not doing so is to be cut off from opportunities in the broader economy. How they justify this usually is, you know, they say it's expensive to run a school. We need the money for this and that. But when you look at where the money is going to in most colleges and universities, it's going to infrastructure, to new buildings. You know, in the university where I once taught, it was going to luxury dorms that rivaled four-star hotels, you know, which was to lure in a wealthier caliber of student. It goes to administration, which is bloated considerably as the number of tenure track faculty has shrunk. And so where it's not going is it's not going to teaching, and it's not going, you know, to help support financially the students that wouldn't be able to pay these tuition costs.
Right. Do you want to just talk a little bit about, for people who go into higher ed, you know, someone like me who, you know, has an arts degree, I'd always imagined if I did an MA or PhD, it would be to become a professor, you know, and now that option seems even less and less tenable. Can you say anything about what's happening there?
Yes. I mean, basically 76% of professors are working off the tenure track. The number of tenure track jobs are shrinking. The really dire thing about this is the amount of money that a non-tenure track professor is paid, especially when they're working as an adjunct, where the average is about, you know, $2,700 per course. And so to even make a poverty level wage in the United States, you'll have to be able to find 9 courses to teach, you know, usually at multiple schools. This is an impossible lifestyle. And so adjuncts tend to be, you know, one of, I guess, 3 groups of people. They're either very wealthy, and so if they're still looking for an academic job and this is a way to buy their time on the market, this is something they can do because they have extra money to live off of. Or they're people that are taking on debt, and this is true of, you know, they're also taking on debt to get through their PhD programs or their MA programs. Or in some cases, they're homeless, they are getting food stamps, you know, they're living in poverty, and they're often teaching students that are themselves struggling to pay for their education. And so what you have is this environment where neither, you know, the teacher or the student is supported in the current economy in a way that facilitates good learning conditions in the classroom.
And do you feel the quality of education is going down as a result in general, or what's your sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a lot of different things that are bringing the quality of education down. You know, there are things like grade inflation or purchased credentials. You know, with adjuncts, I want to be careful because I think that the vast majority of adjuncts are good teachers. You know, they're people that are usually working incredibly hard, that have great qualifications and that have been very unlucky in this job market. But any professor who is working for that low wage in that kind of precarious condition and teaching at multiple colleges, you know, driving from place to place all day, holding office hours out of the car, denied basic materials and supplies to teach their courses, they're not going to do a good job, or they're not going to do as good a job as they would if they were fully supported.
So, in a recent article, there was a really powerful article I actually read on Rolling Stones a little while ago called Ripping Off Young America, the College Loan Scandal. It was by a journalist named Matt Tobias. He compared the student loan lending crisis to that of the mortgage crisis and debt bubble of 2008. He said that the Federal Advisory Council has warned that recent growth in student loan debt has parallels to the housing crisis, and citing the significant growth of subsidized lending as a major factor in the student debt crisis. I'm wondering first if you agree with this comparison, and if so, what could be some of the outcomes of this bubbling effect of student loan in the longer term? Will this situation just become unsustainable? What's your sense of that?
Yes, I agree with it. I also think it's going to become unsustainable, both for the current generation coping with, you know, record unemployment and record debt at the same time right now. But when you look at it more broadly, when you think about this generation of people, you know, now in their 20s and their 30s, they're having children of their own. And what I cannot understand is how anybody is going to pay for their child to go to college when tuition is growing at an exponential rate, when people are making less money, when they're saving less money, and when they're also paying off their own student loans. You know, like I know almost no one who has a college fund for their children. including me. And, you know, we're not suffering in my household. We're just able to pay our bills and with nothing left over. And I think that that's a pretty common situation because the cost of living has spiraled out of control. The other thing is that, you know, we have a generation that is more educated than any other in history, but that education has not led to employment opportunities. And so I think people look at a college education and they wonder, well, was this worth it? You know, what is the value of this? Was it worth all the debt? Was it worth all the money? And do I want the same thing for my children, or do I want to think about things in a different way? So I'm hopeful that because this situation is so common, that the kind of credentialism that's buffered the higher education economy will change, and that either, you know, prices will become more reasonable or standards for employment will start to shift to reflect the financial inability of most people to participate in this economy.
Interesting, yeah. So in an article you wrote, you called the unaffordable boomer dream. And you say that although race and gender barriers have broken down in many ways in the last 50 years, although there's still a lot of ways to go, as we both know, for our generation, economic strictures have tightened and financial barriers are really the barriers of our generation, the major barriers, and are much worse than our boomer parents 50 years ago. And as you were saying, this is showing up, you know, in the fact that, you know, now a college degree is just a requirement for even like secretary jobs, you know, a minimum job requirement. And yet there's this way in which, you know, we're getting our education and then, you know, we can't actually get jobs commensurate with our education. But if we don't have the degree, we really have no chance at all. I'm curious in this, you know, because I was interested in this article, The Unaffordable Boomer Dream, and the writing you did, you were kind of responding to someone who was in the education field, a female boomer. The president of Harvard, right, okay. And I noticed there's still, I wonder if you sense a sort of mismatch still happening between a lot of the mindset of boomers and the way they even raise their children, and then the kind of economy that we're now inheriting that has created a bit of a disjuncture. And even like I've noticed in some of my conversations with boomers, like they really don't get, like in certain ways, why we're struggling so much. I mean, there seems to be a bit of a disconnect in the mindset. And I'm wondering if it's partly, you know, the boomers growing up at a time of an economic boom and teaching their kids within that boom about certain expectations they could have when they came out, you know, into the workforce. Do you see any disconnects there? Do you think there's some shift that has to happen in the older generations and seeing what we're up against? Or what's your sense of that?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is right. You know, the time in which the boomers were raised is actually an anomaly in American history. You know, it's a time of where wages grew, where opportunities grew for most people. It was also a time where there was a social safety net, where a lot of people were going to college on, you know, things like the GI Bill. And there's, you know, a real possibility that you could be born in one walk of life and you could work your way up. This is also when higher education began to expand. And so, you know, one thing that the boomer generation is known for and that's significant is that they kind of upended this aristocracy that had dominated elite fields, you know, particularly higher education for most of American history, locking out minorities, locking out people from poor walks of life, and then replaced it with what they envisioned as a meritocracy, where you would succeed based on hard work, based on talent, based on education in particular. And so education was sort of promoted as this way out of poverty. What happened, you know, in the mid to late 1970s is that wages for most people went down. You know, factories closed. There was a huge shift in the blue collar economy and in your ability to support a family on that kind of job. And so education became, you know, more important. At the same time, it also became more expensive. And that expense, combined with kind of the ethos of meritocracy, made basically, you know, an entrenched meritocracy, where on one hand, technically, it was your hard work, your ability, you know, your test scores, things that have to do with your mental acuity that were supposed to sort of pave your way in the world. But in order to do any of those things, you needed money. You needed to be born in a good school district. You needed to pay to take the SATs and take them multiple times. You needed to be able to afford college tuition. And most people can't do that. And it's become very extreme, especially over the past decade. You know, the average student going to Yale or Harvard comes from a family making over $200,000 a year, which is about 3% of the American population falls into that category. almost no one making, you know, the median income, which is about $50,000, goes to these schools. And they like to advertise themselves, oh, we'll pay for you. We'll pay everything if you're from that bracket and you apply. But the way they get around this is by basically accepting almost no one from this bracket and then, you know, re-perpetuating this class hierarchy that, you know, melds with a alleged meritocratic hierarchy as well.
The top Ivy Leagues were more based on meritocracy, you'd say, in the boomer generation, and that's shifted in ours.
Yeah, I mean, they were never completely based on meritocracy. Yeah. They're always, you know, an old money, old world kind of place, but you definitely had a shift in demographics from like about the 50s, 60s onward. And you still sort of see that. It's just the demographic that doesn't shift is money and class. And that remains the same. That's true for most elite liberal arts schools as well. It's true to some degree for state schools. You know, it should be noted that the majority of Americans don't go to these schools. You know, they go to community colleges, or many aren't going to, you know, any kind of college. But people who do that are at a huge disadvantage. And that is, you know, part of what I talk about when I discuss prestige economy, is that having this name brand school, it makes an enormous difference in certain professions. And you will be, you know, basically locked out of a lot of professions without this kind of brand affiliation to your background.
So with this increasing inaccessibility of higher ed, I did want to talk with you a bit about potential alternatives, things that are starting to emerge, which seems inevitable, and certain initiatives that are even posing themselves as an alternative to the traditional academic route. One of the first alternatives is MOOCs, massive open online courses. There's a lot of talk about MOOCs right now, a lot about the potential for it to even rival traditional academia. I was wondering if you could just say a little bit about what a MOOC is. Some people might not know what it is or how it works. And then what you think of it. Do you think it could actually rival traditional education or be a substantial alternative to going to university for young people?
Well, the MOOC train has kind of come and gone at this point. One of the founders of the companies that promoted MOOCs basically said they didn't work because only about like 10% of people were finishing them. I don't know the exact number. MOOC is a massive open online course. And my critique of MOOCs really has to do with the massive part. You know, people are not getting personalized instruction. They're not participating in a classroom with their peers. They're not asking questions. That, you know, there's that interpersonal component of education that's lost not only in MOOCs, but I would say is lost in any kind of massive in-person lecture course. And so that's really, I think, where the problem lies more than with technology. I think with technology, there's a lot of potential, you know, for good. I have no problem really with online learning, and especially with using the internet to do different types of courses or present information, you know, to a broader range of people. I think that's good. I think that MOOCs are in no way a replacement for, you know, a traditional higher education. I think that, you know, on occasion, they're a nice complement.
And also because I think you'd mentioned in your article that, you know, a university degree, if we're talking about the prestige economy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a MOOC degree is not going to be the same.
Yeah.
It's just not going to replace that.
No one is going to take your MOOC degree seriously. There are certain industries that, you know, kind of have a different conception of prestige and will overlook things like the lack of a college degree. And the main industry that does that, I would say, is technology. You know, they take a pride in that. You know, somebody like Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg are dropouts and they founded their own company. And so they have a different way of kind of evaluating ability or talent. And they really like to position themselves as somebody, you know, opposing this old guard. But the number of success stories that are similar to somebody like Mark Zuckerberg are extremely small, and most people can't really, you know, live their lives in that way. They unfortunately are stuck in this broader system where you submit, you know, a resume to a company, and one of the first things to look at is where you went to school. And, you know, I think that that's wrong. I think that where you go to school is not really a sign of your intelligence or ability. But at the same time, to kind of dismiss the fact that that is how people are regarded, you know, it's to deny that fact.
Yeah. So do you see other, I mean, I've seen other online educational models emerging. I think that's probably going to happen more and more, even if MOOCs are the first phase didn't work. There's definitely stuff emerging. Do you feel optimistic about any initiatives you're seeing happening or alternative learning environments, online certificates, things that you think could equip people for jobs of the future?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I've occasionally guest lectured in online courses and, you know, found the experience not that encouraging, just because there is such a level of depersonalization, at least the way that I guess, you know, it has to do with the structure of the technology that people are using to host these classes, which I don't think always lends itself to a stimulating learning environment. You know, I mean, I'm kind of mixed. I think it depends on the instructor, on the makeup of the course, on exactly what they're doing. You know, I'm happy about the internet in general. I'm happy that, you know, there's this wealth of knowledge that's out there. Like my area of expertise when I was doing my dissertation was Central Asia. And, you know, just in the last 10 years alone, it's like, you know, great works of history and literature have been translated and uploaded. And, you know, this is where a lot of intellectual life is happening, particularly in places that people can't visit. So, you know, I'm very pro technology. I'm very pro internet. I'm not really pro replacing, you know, entire structures of education that rely on the ability of people to ask questions and have debates and have discussions with a kind of, you know, faceless technology, with kind of just looking up things on your own and not being able to share or debate ideas.
Right. So do you think, like, is your sense that these traditional institutions are just going to have to shift at some point? Or what's your sense of where the future of this might go?
It's really tough to tell. I mean, one thing that's interesting now is that even the upper end, you know, even upper middle class people are struggling in this economy. They're graduating from college with a lot of debt because the tuition rates for these colleges are so insane that, you know, even if you make like over $100,000 a year, you're going to have massive debt from going to college. And they can't find jobs. And so we're seeing real downward mobility. And I think when you have a whole generation, you know, who is shifting downward, they're just not going to be able to pay for it. Like it's a very kind of simple question of like, they will look at this, ask, is it worth it? And do I have the money? And they're going to say no. And so really the change is going to happen when children who are people who are children now become teenagers and their parents, and they start going through this whole process of what should we do about higher education. I think that's when you might see others, you know, potential alternatives emerging because people will be so frustrated. On the other hand, you know, you can't divorce any of these questions from the broader economy. And what we have now is this kind of unprecedented level of, you know, soaring stocks and very high unemployment and a kind of elite economy that runs separately than the rest, than the economy runs for regular people. And I think that that's made, you know, ordinary people feel powerless. Like there's nothing that they could really do. You know, Congress is dominated by millionaires. Most people in power don't care about this unemployment rate because it doesn't affect them and it doesn't affect people they know. And so it's very difficult to kind of predict where things are going to go when you have all of these factors interacting at the same time.
So, well, in the light of all this and all of these really, I mean, they're hard realities, and I think they're really important. The more my generation particularly is knowledgeable and literate of what's going on, we'll be able to make better choices for ourselves. And I'm curious if you, you know, in the face of all this, do you have any sort of last words of advice or just, you know, what you would say to a young person who's considering going to school, going to college or not, and trying to figure out their career path? Do you have any sense of words of wisdom that you would give?
My only real advice is avoid debt. Avoid debt as much as you can. You know, if that means going to college closer to home, then so be it. You know, look for fellowships, look for scholarships, look for ways that you can be financially supported. Don't assume that because an institution has a fancy name or a storied history, that that's necessarily going to trade off for you in terms of financial opportunities in the future. I think at one point it did, but what you're now seeing is, you know, you get a degree from like Harvard, you go out in the world, and people will want to hire you to work unpaid jobs. Like there's this assumption that, you know, Harvard degree means you have family wealth. Family wealth means you can be a low-paid employee or an unpaid intern in an expensive city. And so there's this whole strange career track that does not really apply to regular people. I see a lot of people just kind of reevaluating what it means to be successful on their own terms, you know, using social media to form different kinds of alliances and groups. I see cities that are supporting, you know, different kind of career paths. Like in Detroit, they're giving away houses. They're doing a writers in residence program where if you are a writer, they will literally give you a house if you are willing to live in Detroit for 2 years with the intention that you'll then stay in Detroit, you know, after hopefully and be part of a broader community. But you see these kind of efforts at revitalization that are also connected to new ways of spurring employment and spurring kind of a, you know, a new basis in society. away from centers of wealth, like a more diversified geographical spread of employment. And so, you know, I think I'm hopeful about all that. I think that the economy at this point, because, you know, the crash was 6 years ago, is making people be a little more innovative and open-minded about where they want to go.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, because there's a lot of talk definitely amongst my friends about kind of the rise of entrepreneurs and more people becoming entrepreneurs. And it's interesting because I have sort of mixed feelings about it. In some ways, I am my own entrepreneur. And then I also have some concerns about just entrepreneurs generally are the minority in an economy. And so if everyone became entrepreneurs or it became a majority, I just wonder about the competing for attention. And I know, I was just curious if you have any insight on the future of like entrepreneurs as part of this moving out of this problem in the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, especially people like Thomas Friedman, they just look at the economy and they see that no one has a job and they're like, oh, be an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's this easy thing. Like it doesn't require any kind of startup capital or personal advantage. I think being an entrepreneur is a kind of an unrealistic option for most people, especially in America, because our social safety net is just, you know, there isn't one really. And like, in order to get benefits, you know, and healthcare, although, you know, now we have Obamacare, so that's starting to change, you know, you need to have a job. And so this idea of striking out on your own is very frightening to a lot of people because they could lose financially in a very big way. You know, I don't see anything wrong with entrepreneurship. I think the internet has made it possible for people to kind of showcase their abilities and gain an audience on their own without having to go through these gatekeepers. And I think that that's a great thing. You know, I hope things move in that direction. I think that institutions are very resistant to that and they don't like these kind of independent voices coming out. They either try to co-opt them or they outright steal their material. But I think it's good that there are these voices, especially critical voices, you know, that are pushing in a different direction.
Great. Well, thank you so much for making the time to talk to me. It's really good to talk with you, and I'm excited to share the dialogue. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Shut your eyes.